call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order here. Before we get started, if anyone's here on Senate Bill 62, that's not ready, so that will not be taken up today. We will start today with a procedural transaction here to get a bill back to the committee for the purpose of adopting a conforming amendment. Everybody pay attention so that you understand fully. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2261.
Senator Morse moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2261. This motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, then the rules are suspended. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2261 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2261 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing any objection? If not, the motion carries and the measure is once again is before the committee. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move to...
No, that's my turn now. Yeah. Sorry, Senator Morse. Although you could do it, too. You're vice chair. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2261.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 2261 as amended, dated 4/10/2009.
Senator Morse moves to adopt the HB 2261-1 amendments dated 4/10/2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So if not, the motion carries and the amendments are adopted. Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morse moves House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Good. The motion, any objection? Senator Delbert.
Discussion. It's like, well, have we read this before?
Senator.
My objection is just a lack of being able to read it and consider it.
This is a conflict amendment, Senator Telfer. Frank,
you? Chair, I think we had a referral to Ways and Means on that bill.
Yes, we did. I thought we did.
There's no referral to Ways and Means.
No referral to Ways and Means. Okay. All right. Okay, Senator Morse, this motion has not passed. Senator Morse, I would now prefer that you make a motion to move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, since apparently it does not have a referral to Ways and Means. Thank heavens Senator Telfer stopped us from passing this motion. Otherwise, I don't know what we'd do. So, Senator Morse, if you would just move this bill to the floor.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended?
As amended.
As amended.
Senator Morse has moved House Bill 2261 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Okay, now, is there any discussion? Senator Telfer. Okay, any objection? So ordered. Okay, this for folks in the audience and on the committee, this was these amendments are conflict amendments with our Scribner's bill that, in hindsight, I wish we'd saved us till the very, very end. But we didn't, so now we're stuck. Okay, now I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 898. Mazin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 898 is what the bill attempts to do is modify the amount of the privilege tax that way we calculate this, that the city can charge a distributing utility, and in the bill you would have the amendments or the amending of the law, basically starting on your first page, line 16, where you take that the city allows for the privilege tax. This is not to increase to exceed 5%, But instead of having the base be the year 1999, the base of the revenue that is done in the city, it will be the three of the last 5 years as the average that would be estimated as the base for the tax. Also, it takes out the requirement that the cities cannot rescind a tax that was enacted before 1999 and do another one post-1999 for the different amounts. And that's the deletion from the law on line 22 going all the way to line 27.
Okay. We may have another question on that particular section, but we'll call Daniel Eisenbeis up to tell us what this bill is for. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 898 today. This is really a technical fix to a pretty obscure part of statute that was put in place in 1999. I've provided you with written testimony, which is, I'll note, is two-sided, that goes into more detail than I may offer you today in written comments, but please speak up if you have any questions, because I know that this is a somewhat technical and complex issue, and I believe that there are a lot of misunderstandings about this bill. Cities have the responsibility to manage the public right-of-way for the benefit of the public. Part of that responsibility includes levying a privilege tax or franchise fee on special use of the right-of-way, such as for electrical distribution, those sorts of uses that go beyond the sort of typical use of the right-of-way for travel. And in fact, cities have been using franchise agreements and privilege taxes for just that purpose for a very long time, longer than the existence of the United States of America. Traditionally, a privilege tax is based upon the revenue of an electrical utility in the jurisdiction of the city. However, in 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1149, which restructured the electrical industry in the state of Oregon. That allowed companies to sell electricity to non-residential customers using the distribution lines of the traditional utility, in recognition that doing so could cause problems for cities in their ability to collect franchise fees or a privilege tax when it's based upon the revenue of the distributing utility, the legislature developed a mechanism called the volumetric rate in order to recapture potentially lost revenues. When Senate Bill 1149 was passed, the legislature included very explicit language reaffirming the right of cities to collect a franchise fee or privilege tax. State statute right now says nothing shall diminish or authorize regulations that diminish a city's authority to control the use of its rights of way and to collect license fees, privilege taxes, rent, or other charges for the use of the city's rights of way. However, the volumetric rate that was developed, which essentially attempts to translate a typical privilege tax for a customer class based upon revenue of the distributing utility into a tax per kilowatt hour that's actually distributed, whether it's sold by that utility or by an independent company, is hinged upon the 1999 revenues of the distributing utility. That was put in place at a time when many people anticipated that electrical rates would actually go down from 1999 levels rather than continue to increase. And in that sense, it would have, if that had been the case, would have assured that cities would have maintained the privilege tax revenues or the equivalent franchise fee revenues that they were collecting at that point in time. Instead, rates have gone up and electrical loads have increased as well. So essentially the 1999 basis for the privilege tax creates an artificial ceiling on what cities would be able to recoup if they were to go this route, which makes it completely unworkable. So in practical terms, what has happened in a few isolated cases where large customers have chosen to purchase their power from an independent supplier rather than from a distributing utility is that even though that utility is still distributed by the traditional utility, there is not a mechanism for cities to levy a privilege tax on distribution of that electricity, and the fact that the mechanism that is presented by state statute based on 1999 revenues means that cities would actually come out losing revenue opting for that mechanism rather than just essentially ignoring it. So that is the basis for this bill. But what I want to make clear is that in 1999, when the legislature passed Senate Bill 1149, there was explicit reaffirmation of cities' authority to collect privilege taxes and franchise fees. This bill is really an attempt to provide a technical fix to language in that bill to uphold that principle. This is not a tax increase. It closes a loophole to recover tax revenue that has previously been paid. It's not targeted at any single business. It's prospective in nature. It doesn't upset any current contracts or agreements. It does not upset existing franchise agreements or contracts between a single customer and an independent service supplier. And it treats all the electricity in a jurisdiction or each kilowatt hour in a customer class equally. It levels the playing field, so to speak. The bottom line is that it closes an important tax loophole that is important to cities because franchise fees, generally speaking, are the second most important source of revenue for cities at a time when city revenues are declining, just like at all levels of government, and demand for our services remains strong. So with that, the League of Oregon Cities would urge your support for Senate Bill 898, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any way of figuring out, because this is very complicated,
yes,
very technical, is it, if 1149 had not passed in 1999, would this new, the volumetric way of calculating the franchise fee, would that result in more tax than otherwise would have been, or less, or would it be the same?
Well, if Senate Bill 1149 had not ever become law, there would be no need for the volumetric rate, but in essence, if there were a volumetric rate option in place that was not pegged to a single year, then the revenues that would be collected using the volumetric rate would be the same as revenues collected by the gross revenue method. Essentially, that was the attempt made by legislators, was to provide a mechanism to figure out what is the share, so to speak, for each kilowatt hour of tax that should be paid.
And would have worked out just fine if rates had gone down?
Yes. In our estimation, it would have worked out fine because essentially we would have at least maintained the amount of revenue that we were collecting in 1999. But, things did not work out the way that Enron would have liked people to have believed at that point. Rates have actually gone up. And so the discrepancy between 1999 revenues and current revenues, when you consider rate increases and increases in the amount of electricity that's actually being distributed, just continues to grow over time.
Okay. Questions? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So why has it taken 10 years for this to come up?
Well, my understanding, having not been personally involved in the negotiations, was that there was a very strong tendency to try to not reopen Senate Bill 1149, and I think you'll probably hear remarks to that effect today, but from our perspective, this is actually an issue that we raised last session in 2007. This is really a technical fix. It is not a policy change, so to speak, to 1149.
Other questions? Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Just clarification, you said this is not an increase in tax. Will this not generate more revenue for cities?
Well, it could have the effect of generating more revenue than what occurs when the mechanism does not work. But we must recall that the entire point of putting this mechanism in place is to allow a method for cities to recover revenue that is lost when electricity is sold by an independent supplier and no longer captured through the tax on gross revenues of the distributing utility. The other important point to note is that in most cities, there is a franchise agreement between the distributing utility and the city that's negotiated. Although in many cities there is a privilege tax in the ordinance, the franchise agreement is really in lieu of paying the privilege tax. So to the degree that that is the case, if a city were to choose to adopt the volumetric rate, it really just establishes the yardstick for those franchise agreement negotiations. So the effect of this bill would be that it would help establish that yardstick in a proper place, and then when a current franchise agreement expires, it would allow the utility and cities to reference that yardstick when negotiating a new agreement.
Follow up. I'm still looking for clarification. Will this generate more revenue for a city, and thus will any ratepayers be obligated to pay more?
It could generate more revenue for cities, but not necessarily. This is all. It's based on the mechanism that's available, and because these agreements are negotiated, I can't say definitively one way or another. But the purpose is to better account for revenues that are lost when electricity is sold by an independent supplier rather than by a traditional utility that's subject to a franchise agreement or privilege tax.
Why would you be here if it didn't generate more revenue for
cities? Well, our hope would be that it will allow recovery of those revenues and an increase in those cases where electricity does fall off. But really, the bigger interest, Chair Burdick and Senator Telfer, is so that in the future, if there are additional cases of customers opting off of purchasing from a distributing utility, there will be a mechanism in place to recover that revenue that has not yet been lost. As we see things, because this discrepancy continues to increase, it'll only make opting to go that direct route potentially more appealing because essentially there's a tax loophole in place.
And Senator Telfer, did this ever come up in Bend?
Not as a city councilor, not that I recall. But I can tell you that as a city councilor, I'm well aware that the cities are looking for every increase in franchise fees that they can get, particularly today. So that's why I wanted to know, and that always falls on the ratepayer's shoulders. So I'm still looking for that answer, but
yeah.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, this bill does nothing to change the overall limitation on the percentage that may be charged in the form of a privilege tax, which is limited in state statute to no more than 5% of revenues of the distributing utility.
Thank you for that. But it doesn't change the percentage. It changes the base on which that percentage is applied, though. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, now we're all confused. Any more questions? Let's take a couple of opponents here, and then maybe that'll round it out a little bit. Don't go far, Dan. We'll take Michael Early and Mike Siebers.
Just Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'd like to be clear on just a couple of points in response to the question.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. We represent large users of electricity in the state of Oregon on electric rate matters. I'd like to provide some clarity to what this bill does. One, it is not a technical change. It is a rate increase, a significant tax increase, rather, a significant tax increase. And third, and perhaps more most important, the cities are collecting more revenues today under the existing law than they collected in 1999, and this bill would simply allow them the opportunity to collect more. First of all, why does this increase taxes? It's because, as Senator Telfer pointed out, the percentage remains the same. It's 5%, but it's the base to which the tax is applied. And what this provision does is updates the base to use current sales revenues by the utility and current loads as opposed to 1990 loads. And as you're all familiar, since 1999, utility rates and utility revenues have dramatically increased, in part because of the Western energy crisis. And they far exceeded the increase in loads. So that ratio has increased. So this is plainly a tax increase over the tax that's in the current statute. Secondly, this was part of a deal in 1149, back in 1999, that provided for direct access. And one of the important features that was not mentioned by the earlier witness was that the franchise fee that a city was allowed to charge was increased from 3.5% to 5% as part of that package. And that allowed cities to use that provision in the law to immediately increase the amount of revenues they collected. And they continued to use that provision. What this bill is all about is they simply want to change the rules now. They perceive that there's an opportunity to even further increase my revenues if I can go over and use the volumetric tax, provided I don't have to use 1999 as the base, that I can use current revenues as the base. So this isn't about lost revenues. This is about more revenues for the city. So I am here on behalf of my members in Oregon to urge you to oppose this bill. This is the most inopportune time in the last decade to impose further tax increases on business. They simply cannot afford it, and as you hear shortly, it will put jobs at risk. In your package as well, I've handed out a letter from Intel. Intel is one of the companies that could be very significantly impacted.
Did you mean Boeing?
Well, there's a Boeing and an Intel letter.
I don't see an Intel letter.
Blue Heron is the only one I have.
It's in the manila envelope?
We got Blue Heron, we got Boeing. I'm not seeing Intel. Here comes Intel.
The Intel letter expands upon the point I made that this, the volumetric tax was part of an overall package developed in 1999. The cities were part and parcel of the negotiations that resulted in that package. It was a compromise. There was give and take on our part as well as theirs. Part of that was the increase of the franchise fee from 3.5% to 5%, which has provided them that benefit for the last decade, the benefit to the cities. And we think it's inappropriate and counterproductive to maintaining the competitive position of Oregon businesses in order to impose an additional tax, again, as I said, not to make up for lost revenues, but to generate additional tax revenues. Secondly, there is the Boeing letter, which touches upon the same sort of issue. So our point being here, these are major employers in the state, many of them struggling in difficult markets, not just pulp and paper, but even some of our more manufacturers like Boeing and Intel are facing difficult economic circumstances. So in that light, I don't think there's a justification to go forward with this bill. Thank you.
Okay, can you respond to the point that that Mr. Eisenbeist made, that the agreement that was made in Senate Bill 1149 worked while rates were, if rates went down, but if rates went up, then it amounts to a loophole?
Well, there's no loophole. In fact, rates have gone up, and that is our point. That's why this is a tax increase. But as a consequence of rates going up, they are recovering more revenues today than they did in 1999.
But as a customer, your members, customers, have their rates gone up since 1999?
Their overall electric rates? Absolutely.
But not as much as they would if this were in effect, correct?
Well, this affects the tax component, but their rates, as well as everyone else.
I'm talking about the tax burden on them. Has that gone up?
It depends on which option the city chose. But their tax burden has also increased. It's increased to a different percentage, because if they are in direct access, then the products they buy from the utility, which are transportation and transmission, are a smaller component of their overall costs. But those costs have gone up. The tax component of those costs have gone up.
I mean, do you find that it's enough of an incentive under the current system for companies to switch and use another utility to provide their electricity?
The difference between buying your commodity from the utility or from a marketer varies from time to time. And I think Mr. Sievers can indicate that sometimes those margins are very slim. And this could make the difference between whether you choose to provide, purchase your commodity from a marketer or from the utility. So this tax impact could, in fact, in some cases, overwhelm the benefits of the supplier choice.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Senator Telfer, none of this sounds familiar from the city's standpoint.
Well, I think what sounds familiar is we need more money from franchise fees, and how do we get it? That's kind of what I've heard for 6 years, and I'm still hearing it. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Sievers. I'm the president and the chief operating executive officer of Blue Heron Paper Company. And I'll try and bring a little bit of clarity to what Michael Early said. And yes, it could have a significant impact in the future if things changed on our decision to buy on open access. And it could actually impact power that we've already bought, because when you go to the market and you have access to the market, you would do different kind of deals than you might do just buying from a local IOU provider. And those deals are long-term deals. You think you know what your costs are going to be under the conditions of those deals. And for taxes to change, or for a company that is in open access to get a change in tax, particularly if it's a significant change, it might change the benefit of what you're trying to already get and what you've already purchased ahead. And such would be the case with us, I could tell you that. I'm here today representing our employee owners. We are a 100% employee-owned company through an ESOP structure, and we are opposed to this Senate bill on the basis that it unfairly singles out customers' buying power on open access rates and applies a very onerous and unexpected tax burden specifically on companies like us. It looks like a direct attack, actually, on direct access customers, and it's definitely another bite at the tax apple for people that are buying on the direct access market. When open access legislation was developed, there were lots of trade-offs that were made to placate all the interested parties. privilege taxes, which this obviously is, were vetted at the time, and all the stakeholders bought off on the process, whether they liked it or not. It was a huge undertaking, and everybody bought off on that process at the time. And the biggest change at the time was the addition of this 3% public purpose charge that we all pay, and it is part of the development that came out of open access. And it has a lot of good purposes. It funds energy conservation education for schools. A component goes to electricity conservation efforts. A component goes to renewable energy. A component goes to low-income assistance. And so there's all these things already out there, and this came about when open access was first created. Our specific average amount that we pay in public purpose charges from year to year for the last 5 years has averaged about $630,000 a year. That's what we already pay as a result of going to open access. And that charge came about as part of the development of open access. We're trying to ferret through how much more this might cost us, but if you take a volumetric tax like this and apply it to the kind of load that we have in our facility, it looks like it could potentially add another $1 million a year in cost to us. And that would be a huge cost for somebody like us. We're a small company. We have 250 employees. People like to think of paper companies as big companies that make a lot of money. Well, the truth of the matter is we really move a lot of cash around, but we don't make a lot of money. Times have really been tough the last couple of years. Last year we cut all our employee wages 10%. We've been operating under very tight cost control for the last couple of years. Since December of this year, we have been having rolling curtailments of parts of our operation because we don't have enough orders. Prices are dropping, and there's no way we could pass $1 million in extra cost along to our customers. It just couldn't happen. So we can ill afford in these kind of times to have any kind of other burdensome taxes or costs put on us that would make us even less competitive than we already are. And we sell into a global marketplace, so we have to get every little advantage we can, and we had some advantage buying our power on the open access market. But now it looks like instead of paying out $630,000 a year for the public purpose charge, it might cost us $1.5 million or $1.6 million to have the privilege to go to the open market to buy power to try and compete with our local providers' rates. And that just doesn't seem right to me. Basically, it undermines the fundamental reason why open access was developed to begin with. So I would say, besides just plain unfairness of this bill, it's also a little bit misleading. The basic language suggests certain things. However, the proposed mechanism of calculating it could create unintended consequences. It looks to us like it could actually, by being able to select three of 5 years and doing an averaging with that mechanism, it might even create more than a 5% tax for existing customers, let alone what it does to people on open access. This is not the time or the appropriate mechanism with which to do any kind of increase. And, I can sympathize with cities. I know everybody would like more revenue. We would like more revenue. In a good year, our company might make net income of $3 or $4 million, even though we infuse $70 million in a year into the state of Oregon, and that goes to the state coffers, the county, the city of Oregon City, where we are. And that goes there in good times or bad, whether we're making a profit or not. That's an infusion our company makes into the state economy because most of our customers are outside the state. So money we bring in, we buy goods and services, we have wages that we pay into the local economy, and that doesn't change regardless of whether we make profit or not. But this thing just seems to be unfair, should be scrapped, and cities should have to live up to the privileged tax agreements they made when open access laws were created. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If your business ceased and the revenue that you're now paying, does that by this bill transfer to the other ratepayers that are buying from, are buying direct and or buying through investor-owned utilities? As I understand the previous testimony, that when you lose that revenue, that it is just appropriated to the then existing customers. Is that what happens?
The volumetric bill charges a unit charge. It's dollars per megawatt hour delivered. So if Blue Heron paper should go away, the city would have to recalculate that unit charge. Obviously, the revenues would go down, but also the load would go down as well. So it depends on how that ratio moves, to what extent those lost revenues would or would not be recovered from other customers. Is that clear?
I think I understand it. Thank you. I was not understanding it previously.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Jeff Bissonnette.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. And despite my relative youth, I'm one of the few folks that were around, along with the chair and then Representative Rosenbaum, in the development of Senate Bill 1149. And I guess I just wanted to come before the committee this afternoon and say and answer directly a question from Senator Rosenbaum. Senate Bill 1149 passed 10 years ago. What's taken so long? This is actually an issue that the cities raised within a few years of the passage and subsequent enactment in 2002 of 1149. And because of the Western energy crisis and some of the lack of clarity that brought up in terms of the energy markets, in terms of some of the other issues that kind of continued to swirl around Senate Bill 1149 sort of immediately following its passage, the cities basically said, okay, we can sort of put off the discussion. We're asked that up through last session, and they did put it on the table around the topic of Senate Bill 838, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, but somewhere along the line, there was a decision made that that wasn't the vehicle to decide this, and so or decide this issue. And so, this session, they put in their own bill. So, I think that I'm basically here to testify that the deal in Senate Bill 1149 was to keep cities whole. And so, I think the policy call that the committee is being asked to make is our cities being kept whole. And I think a lot of that discussion happens on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. And on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis is the is the standard set forth in or by 1149 back in 1999 working for cities. And that is the question I think that we have to answer today. And so I think it's appropriate that the cities put it put that issue on the table. I think that it's also more than fair for other folks to make that case, but I think that case needs to be made, and the committee needs to kind of sort through those issues and decide. But that is something that the cities have been talking about for a while. I think that another thing for the committee to think about is that the focus of Senate Bill 1149 was to figure out how to manage a transition from a completely and totally integrated utility environment to one that allowed some level of direct access, not for residential customers, not for small commercial customers, but for large commercial and industrial customers. And so there were a lot of trade-offs and a lot of balancing that was done to achieve the I think, pretty elegant overall result that was Senate Bill 1149. But I think that we've had now 10 years to look at how direct access has happened and sort of the results of some of those, some of those balancing efforts. One of the previous speakers talked about the public purpose charge, and that is something that was created through Senate Bill 1149. It is separate and apart from the franchise fee. Although I will say that there are similarities between public purposes and the franchise fees in that they have always been a part of rates and they've always been a part of the energy business. It was just that Senate Bill 1149, again, in figuring out how to move from a totally vertically integrated utility world to a world where direct access was permitted for some customers, we handle them differently, and we handle them differently, and by and large, it's worked out pretty well. The issue is that the cities are asking is did the decision we made on franchise fees also work out well for cities on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis? And so we are happy to take part in that discussion if the committee chooses to take it up, and we offer our help in thinking through both on a memory basis and on a current times basis on what the right policy decision is today. So I thank you for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, you didn't sign up for or against this bill. Are you neutral on the bill, or how are you?
I think that our position would best be characterized as neutral. However, I did want to come up in support of the city's need to talk about this issue and to acknowledge that they have put it on the table in past years, and so it is something that I think is important to talk about. And also, too, I will say that, in terms of kind of working out the numbers, we haven't figured out sort of the rate impact or cost impact on residential ratepayers, but would be happy to take that up if the and determine if that was a significant impact or not on the part of residential ratepayers. My suspicion is that it would probably be pretty modest if you decided to change it, but we haven't done those exact calculations yet, but we'd be happy to do that if the committee decided to pick this bill up and move forward with it.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing would be very helpful for me, and I suspect maybe for the committee as a whole, would be to understand what has happened to this revenue. We heard testimony that it hasn't decreased. It's actually gone up. Would be to understand what the revenues have been over time and to get a little better grasp of if there is a deficiency and how big is it.
I think we'll probably bring Mr. Eisenbeis back. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan, you want to come back and address maybe Senator Morris's question and just kind of tell us where we are in terms of the overall revenue picture?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris. For the record, again, Daniel Eisenbeis, League of Oregon Cities. As Mr. Bissonnette stated, this is really something that plays out on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. I cannot say what's happened generally with revenues over time. I can say that in some cases, such as in the city of Hillsborough, when a large industrial customer went direct market, they took a year-over-year hit of over $1 million in franchise fee revenues. This is not so much about what's happened due to an increase in load with population growth, that sort of thing, but rather about addressing an issue where, in those cases where customers have gone direct market, the companies that are selling that electricity are currently not paying a tax on the electricity that they're selling and is being distributed through the poles and wires that everybody else pays a distribution tax on when they're purchasing through the distributing utility.
Okay. Senator Morris, did that answer your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm getting a up here and go testify.
Okay.
If I may have an excuse.
Now, please go.
Just a moment.
We'll live in suspense as to whether that answered your question or not. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Telfer?
No, it's starting to come back, though. It is ringing a bell.
I knew. Okay. Any other questions, Senator Rosenbaum? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on... Oh, is there anybody else who wants to talk on this? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 898 and open a work session on Senate Bill 77. Anna, do you want to call over to Mr. Nesbitt and see if he wants to... Oh, you're here. Okay. I saw him in there earlier. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, the members of the committee are receiving hot off the press fiscal impact on the Dash 3 amendments, which you have before you, for Senate Bill 77. As you recall, this was part of two companion bills, 77 and 78, that were the result of the governor's task force on county timber payments and services. And what this, what Senate Bill 77 does is it sets up a framework or process whereby county governments or the governor can declare a state of fiscal distress that compromises the ability of the county to provide a minimal level of public services, public safety services. So the bill outlines that process, and the issue that came up in your earlier hearing was concern from the Sheriff's Association that there was not really a formal recognition of a role of the sheriffs, who are the chief public safety officers in the individual counties. And so what the Dash 3 amendment does is make that very explicit in the bill, that the sheriffs are to be consulted at the initial time once the fiscal control board is to be established. They are to meet with the local officials, including the sheriff, and then at the final time of the report, that the public input and input from governing body, including the sheriff, should be included. So that was the gist of the Dash 3 amendments. Your fiscal impact says that there potentially could be a fiscal impact when this process is up and running, but nothing explicit now.
Okay. Let's see. Amber, why don't you come on up and elaborate on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amber Hollister. I'm Governor Kulongoski's Deputy General Counsel. I worked with Deputy Chief of Staff Tim Nesbitt on the Governor's Federal Forest Payments Task Force, and one of the recommendations from that task force was this bill. I'm happy to specifically address any questions that the committee might have. Do you want me to focus on the Dash 3 amendments or the bill as a whole, Senator Burdick?
Actually, both.
Both.
Because it was a while since we've heard this.
Of course. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill creates a new creature called a Public Safety Services Emergency. Both the governor and a county governing body may seek the declaration of a public safety services emergency. Once either of those entities seeks a declaration, the Criminal Justice Commission will go out and research what it looks like on the ground and report back to the governor and the county governing board. At that point, the governor actually makes it a determination whether to declare or not to declare. If the governor elects to declare a public safety services emergency, it would trigger the creation of a financial control board. Financial control boards exist in statute all over the nation. This is not a new idea. We're trying to build on some of the existing good government practices in other states. What that financial control board would do is they would be assigned to a specific county. They would go in and research the fiscal situation, meet with specific actors, and some of those actors are called out in the Dash 3 amendments, including the sheriff, the district attorney, judges, and other appropriate county officials, labor organizations, and other public safety stakeholders to gather information regarding current levels of public safety funding. At that point, the fiscal control board would come back, caucus, and create a recovery plan that would be presented to the county governing body. The county governing body would have an option to approve or reject the plan. If they chose to approve it, the fiscal control board would be there to provide technical assistance in executing the plan. But it's within the county governing body to refuse the plan, in which case they still will have the control board standing by to lend assistance if need be. The other piece of this bill that I should mention is the Criminal Justice Commission, when they go into a county, go sort of down to street level, they will be evaluating the services in that county based on some guidelines that this bill asks them to create. And those guidelines will focus on eight specific areas that are called out in the bill, including county jail operations, law enforcement, investigation and patrol, community corrections, juvenile justice, emergency operations and response, search and rescue operations, criminal prosecution, and court facility operations. Really, from a 30,000-foot view, I think what this bill accomplishes is it puts the legislature, the governor's office, and even to some extent the county officials in a position where when there's a public safety services emergency, they understand exactly what's going on on the ground and what resources are needed, where the gaps might be. So we're in a better position to fill those gaps. And I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. On this fiscal, we've got two kinds of potential impact. One is the indeterminate impact if there is an emergency, and then the other is down in the fourth paragraph, it says that the Criminal Justice Commission's estimates that the cost of travel, et cetera, will be $94,000 in the next biennium, 2009-11 biennium, to get the broad input that the bill requires. And yet we don't have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I'm wondering if you can help us sort through whether we need to do that.
Madam Chair, that's something we could certainly consult with the fiscal office about if they feel they haven't expressed that explicitly to me, but I'd be happy to follow up with them, and we could hold this over till tomorrow and see what their recommendation is.
Okay.
There would have to be some accommodation in the budget for the Criminal Justice Commission if they are to begin this planning process to prepare. So there would have to be some type of a recognition of that. So I'd be might be worth the committee's time if I consulted with LFO and see what they would recommend.
I think I'd like to do that. So what I'd like to do today is give the committee any chance they need to ask questions or resolve any issues. Anybody have any questions? Okay. All right. Thank you. That was a good explanation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 77 and carry Senate Bill 77 over till tomorrow's meeting, where it will be scheduled for another work session. Okay. No other business before the committee? We are adjourned. Okay.